Hi, Andy.
Hi, Victoria.
Today we have one of our own, Dr. Randy Horowitz.
Who has been with our center forever, it seems, as medical director, a very key faculty member.
Yes, and he also is an expert on asthma, and that is what we will be talking about.
Great.
Let's get him on. Dr. Randy Horowitz is the medical director of the Andrew Weil Center for Integrative Medicine and a professor at the University of Arizona. He obtained a PhD in immunology and molecular biology from the University of Florida and his medical degree from the University of Illinois. Randy is triple board certified in internal medicine, allergy and clinical immunology, and integrative medicine. He's the editor of the Oxford University Press textbook, Integrative Rheumatology, and the founding chair of the American Board of Integrative Medicine. Welcome, Randy.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
It's wonderful to have you on the podcast.
Yes.
I think we should start with basics. What is asthma and what causes it?
Wow, there's a podcast right there. So asthma, or as they say in the UK, asthma, goes back a ways. I think Imhotep and some of the papyri, there are notations of symptoms that are congruent with what we call asthma. So asthma, as everyone knows, is a breathing disorder, causes wheezing. But there's three components to asthma that we analyze. The first is bronchoconstriction. So if you think of your lungs, for non-clinical people, think of your lungs as a sponge, and the air goes in those big openings in the sponge. Well, around each opening is a layer of muscle tissue that can contract in response to triggers. That's bronchoconstriction. And obviously, it's like drinking through a straw, less air is getting in. The second component is hyper-responsiveness. People that have asthma, they have twitchy airways. Their airways, in response to a slight provocation, can clamp down quickly. An asthma attack or flare can start pretty rapidly. And the third component, which is interesting because it was noted by Osler, the father of internal medicine back in the 1800s, is inflammation. We kind of forgot about it for a time, and now the pendulum came back, and now it's a central component. So those three work together. Inflammation in the airway causes mucus production. So imagine that your airways clamp down because of bronchoconstriction, and you're getting mucus in there plugging things up. It makes for very difficult breathing. So that's what asthma is. The causes, that's a trickier one. Certainly, there's a genetic predisposition, but I think it actually relies on the question how many types of asthma there are. In medicine, this is a separate digression, but in medicine, we often take symptoms and lump people together and see what works on the symptoms. But truthfully, there are as many different endotypes, phenotypes, or subtypes, if you will, of asthma out there. And so it's really hard to say what causes it. We believe there's a genetic predisposition. There's an epigenetic, or things that happen after you're born, that can impact and cause asthma. And then there's exogenous factors like viruses. In a susceptible person, a virus early in life can really cause a problem.
What about exercise-induced asthma, allergic asthma, stress-induced asthma?
Okay, so when we trained, Andy, and when I was in my allergy fellowship, there were two types of asthma, extrinsic and intrinsic. Extrinsic asthma was allergic asthma. Intrinsic is what old people got for whatever reason. We didn't know why. The development of these subtypes or endotypes or phenotypes, if you will, of asthma, there's dozens now, and they each reflect different pathophysiology. They may be different diseases, but again, we're lumpers, and we tend to put things under an umbrella. What they have in common often are the physical symptoms that are the results. So exercise induced, you'll get the airway bronchoconstriction, which is prominent. There's certain kinetics about after you exercise, this occurs. That may be a whole separate disease. And so, yeah, you're right. There are dozens of types of asthma.
Is asthma in general increasing in frequency in our society?
Yeah, it certainly is. And please don't ask me to explain why, because there's there's a myriad of hypotheses up there. The hygiene hypothesis, we're getting too clean in our environment. You have pets in your environment, you don't have pets. Is it antigen or allergen exposure that leads to it? We have individual facts, but you know, the issue is there are so many, again, to digress, there are so many different components that can cause a medical condition. And to just say one thing is responsible when people's genetic makeup is so different is very difficult to ascertain. But we know some things may predispose a little bit. Having an allergic phenotype or someone who's allergic or atopic, someone who gets a little kitty who gets viruses early in life, those are things that can predispose. There's one other thing that's kind of interesting. A group did a study on mice, and what they did was they gave these mice antibiotics early in life. They put it in the water supply so they would drink it. So right after weaning, they gave these weanlings antibiotic for 4 weeks. And they looked at the GI system and saw that, yeah, the microbiome was affected and everything. Then they co-housed these mice with control animals who didn't get the antibiotic. Over time, their microbiome regulated and they were identical to the control mice. However, they then took the mice and sensitized them to an allergen. That's where you give them increasing doses and then you can make them allergic. And they used house dust mite. So they took the mice, the antibiotic ones and the control ones that were now physiologically identical, and they sensitized them and then they exposed them to house dust mite. Well, the ones that had the antibiotics, remarkably sensitive, allergic, developed asthma-like symptoms. This was months and months later, even though the microbiome had corrected itself. So maybe exposure to antibiotics early in life may be linked to human asthma as well. Let me add one other thing to that. I don't want to belabor it, but they did something really cool. They looked at what was different about these animals, and it turns out there's one particular metabolite of, I want to say, of tryptophan. I could be wrong on the amino acid. One metabolite that was deficient in these mice, in these animals that were exposed early in life. When they repeated the experiment and gave them back this metabolite, then the asthma normalized and controlled. So they're looking at possible therapeutic implications in humans.
That sounds like an epigenetic then alteration.
Absolutely.
So you mentioned something that is paradoxical, that asthma could be caused by too much or by too little pet at home. Can you explain that?
So when I was growing up, I had allergies and asthma. And of course, we had no pets. I had my goldfish gefilte, but that was it. Nothing that I could pet, even though I tried to pet the fish. And were my parents doing me a service or not? It's hard to say. It's hard to say because kitties raised on farms and exposed to many farm animals seem to have less incidence of asthma and allergies in general. So it's really tough to say. The problem is there's so many other factors, genetic factors. And my background in basic science, we did experiments on mice and they had to be inbred mice. You couldn't publish anything with just random wild mice. Why is that? Because they're disparate, they're different. And yet we're doing that in humans all the time. We're trying to reach conclusions when you have a population that's so different. So eventually N equals one, which is why I like integrative medicine, because you look at your patient as an N equals one entity, which is probably true.
Can asthma disappear? Can it go into total remission?
So typically childhood asthma, you'll have a remission period of some years. It could be 10 years, could be 20 years. People think they're cured, but then usually allergic asthma comes back with a vengeance later in life. We don't understand exactly why. It's interesting. They're looking at possible mechanisms for how this can occur. Are there certain cytokines that change in adolescence and come back later in life? But it's a typical pattern where asthma will, except in severe cases, asthma will go through a remission period and then it'll return.
How good are our treatments?
When I was in training, we used corticosteroids and we used prednisone. We used steroids like water because our patients with severe asthma, that kept them out of the hospital, kept them out of the emergency room. And we realized we were doing harm to them, but it was that balance, that fine balance. So the steroids are the atom bomb. Now we have biologic agents, and biologic agents seek to get at the root of the problem, if you will, and it works well for certain patients, but out of the maybe half dozen biologics available, they hit certain cytokines. There's no biologic agent that works for everyone. So what we've done is gone from the atom bomb to the sniper in terms of targeting pathophysiology. Those are the agents, the corticosteroids, and basically the biologics that are trying to get at the root of the disease. Our symptomatic therapies, we have bronchodilators, which could be, there's a short-acting SABAs, long-acting LABAs that last between 4 hours and 12 hours, depending on the formulation. There's some dangers with using a long-acting beta agonist or a LABA without any corticosteroid or anti-inflammatory with it. So we have a whole gradation of severity of asthma. Someone with mild asthma may use a beta agonist maybe once or twice a week. We'll add on to that an anti-inflammatory, usually inhaled corticosteroid, and they'll be on that. Beyond that, there's leukotriene inhibitors. But now people are going first line to these biologic agents, which are tricky. I mean, they work great. I'm afraid the pharmaceutical companies are aiming to get them into first line therapy. I think that's their goal. That may be the case, but you know, long-term implications of using targeting these cytokines is a bit naive. And we don't know if someone's on these agents for 30 years, what the effects may be.
I know you're a big fan of tracking the results of your treatment and your disease with peak flow meters. Can you talk about why you think they're so important and maybe how they're well used?
Yeah, so a peak flow meter is nothing more than an anemometer that measures wind? Yeah, so it's basically that. You blow into it as hard and as fast as you can. It'll establish your well levels. There's a certain percentage of patients, maybe 30%, I haven't seen more than that, that a day or two ahead of an asthma flare, you'll start to see declines in the peak flows. Mm-hmm. So peak flow is the poor man's spirometry, which is the machine in the mm-hmm. doc's office. For patients that respond, it's great. They do it once a day at a certain time of the day, and we can give them a treatment protocol. Usually traffic lights are what they use with little kids, red, yellow, and green. Depending on where their peak flow lies, they can intervene and try to stave off a flare. Our goal in all our patients with asthma is to keep them from having an exacerbation or a flare. So if we know in advance, we can intervene early. And mm-hmm. what that might mean is cranking up the dose of inhaled corticosteroid, putting a patient on an oral corticosteroid, or if you're an integrative practitioner, using the whole slew of modalities that have been shown to be effective. So the peak flow meter, it's good in some people. I like it because it gives the patient a sense of control, which is mm-hmm. something you lose in asthma.
Have you found dietary modification to be useful in some patients? I often tell people to experiment with cutting out cow's milk in all of its forms, maybe wheat, maybe other forms of protein, see what happens.
Yes, it's interesting. The problem I see is I take patients off milk and wheat products and a whole bunch of them respond well. My problem is trying to find a mechanism to explain it. I've stopped trying to do it. It's a trial that's very simple and benefits a large proportion of people. Milk is supposed to be linked to mucus production. There's some evidence for that. But yeah, food sensitivity as a cause of asthma is often ignored. We view it as, oh, if you have allergies, you'll anaphylax the food. We don't think of asthma in the same terms, and maybe we should, as a chronic condition. So I think dietary interventions are important. I think omega-3s have been shown to help. Most of my patients, I put them on a supplement rather than just increasing dietary omega-3s, and it seems to help quite a bit. There have been studies with omega-3s that were very useful. The magic number is about 50%, about half the patients will respond. But when they do respond, it's usually remarkable. And again, the omega-3s in this case, if you think of the arachidonic acid pathway, which is the inflammatory pathway in the body, it leads to the production of compounds called leukotrienes. It also produces prostaglandins, cyclooxygenase, and the other arm, which is involved in maybe rheumatologic conditions. But the leukotrienes, there's B, C, D, E, there's at least four of them, and they're the most potent bronchoconstrictors that we know of. If you instill leukotrienes into the trachea and lungs of animals, you'll really get a vicious response. So by circumventing that normal pathway, by adding and goosing up the amount of omega-3s, preventing the formation of leukotrienes, it seems to help. I found that it helps. I don't know whether that's the exact mechanism, but at least when they did studies in animals and actually in people, when you supplement a crappy American diet with just a couple pills of EPA, you change the composition of the cell membrane within 6 weeks, 3 weeks. So I think that's a very plausible explanation for how they work. So omega-3s, vitamin D, another supplement. I know it's not really nutritional, but supplementing vitamin D, there's a fellow named Rand Sutherland, used to be at Mayo. He did experiments and showed that increasing vitamin D levels are associated with fewer asthma exacerbations. If you look at people with poorly controlled asthma, their vitamin D level tends to be lower. If they have a low vitamin D level, their airway hyper-responsiveness or twitchiness tends to be higher. Their FEV1 or their lung function tends to be lower. So again, I have found in some patients, and I can't predict which ones, when you pull up their vitamin D level to say 50, you can get dramatic responses.
What about some of the other supplements that people take, like quercetin or butterbur?
Quercetin and its pharmaceutical brother, bromelain, are really important. And bromelain is something we use in integrative medicine a lot. If I can digress for just a sec, bromelain was developed by a doctor named Roger Altunian. And when he was young, he had terrible asthma. He did as an adult as well. His grandma would give him tea from Ami Visnaga was the name of the plant, or the Kella plant, would give tea, and that would help him greatly. So he promised his grandmother that he would find out and make her tea famous. He went to work for a company called Fison's in Great Britain back in the 60s, and he had a shoestring budget. So he experimented on himself. He was allergic to guinea pigs, so they had a room down the hall with guinea pigs. He would test compounds out of the tea, and then he would go and rub guinea pigs and see they protected him. And actually, I think it's in the NIH, they have his pulmonary testing when he found bromelain. He found a compound that prevented mast cell degranulation, and it prevented allergies and asthma. They had to find a way to get this dry, desiccated powder into lungs. It just so happened that Altunian was an RAF pilot. So he said, I'm going to make something like the propeller on my plane. So he made something called a spinhaler, which was an airplane propeller in a little tube, and then a needle that punctured the capsule of bromelain. As you inhale through the tube, it spins the propeller, dispersing the powder throughout the lungs. That was the original bromelain. So anyway, getting back to your point, bromelain is a great compound. Before we had inhaled corticosteroids or nebulized, we would give it to pregnant women. We would give it to babies, nebulize it. It's a great compound, very, very safe, and it inhibits mast cell degranulation. Quercetin is a similar compound, and bromelain, by the way, is now only available in the U.S. by nebulized doses, but it works great. Quercetin has the same activity. So quercetin will also inhibit mast cell degranulation. In fact, on a mole per mole basis, it's far more potent, maybe twice as potent as bromelain. The problem is with any of the bioflavonoids like quercetin, they're great compounds. How do you get them into the body? How do you get good absorption? So often they'll combine them with other compounds, vitamin C, bromelain, something like that. But that's the challenge. So these two compounds work really well at inhibiting allergic asthma in a large proportion of people. So I think those are great. I think when it comes to allergic asthma, if you could stave off the allergic inflammation using either an antihistamine, which we don't favor, or a natural antihistamine, as you mentioned, that's another alternative. Doesn't affect the breathing quite as much. I think people have to realize when we're talking about either supplements or even botanicals especially, there are botanical analogs for just about every medication that we use for asthma, whether it's Mawang tea as a beta agonist, which works well, or if it's anticholinergics that we use sometimes, ipratropium versus what would be the natural, well, Datura, but you don't want to use
necessarily. Remember Asbador cigarettes?
Yeah.
That was a Jimson weed cigarette.
Now the problem is you have high school kids, one a year maybe will overdose on that. And what about methyl xanthines, theophylline, first discovered it in Camellia sinensis in tea. So all of these things, they have a basis, a biologically plausible basis for their activity.
Any role for mind-body interventions?
Huge. Huge role. And I love mind body and patients. Often it's difficult with patients because you have to convince them of the power of the mind body connection. And there was one of my mentors was Regis McFadden. He was at the Brigham way back when. He did an experiment with suggestion where he advertised and took 40 patients from the Boston area with allergic asthma, and they wrote down what they were allergic to. And his whole experiment used saline. And so patient A would come in and say, diesel fumes. So they'd say, okay, this tube has diesel fumes, you're going to nebulize it. And what he saw, remarkable, about half the people had severe asthma attacks. The thing that was interesting, they used a beta agonist to rescue them, which was also just saline, and the patients responded well. That article is a classic in suggestion. So we use hypnotherapy quite a bit. Meditation, therapy, the regular run-of-the-mill psychotherapy. If we think about National Jewish Hospital, which is the foremost respiratory hospital in the world, perhaps, their first director was a doc named Murray Peshkin. And what he found was this. He was admitting little kids to the wards with asthma. They'd be in the holding area. The parents would be in the waiting room. The kids would start getting better before any treatment was administered. He saw it so many times, he wrote an article, and he said, what we need is the parentectomy, removal of the parents.
I don't think the attachment theory people probably like that very much.
Okay. It didn't have universal appeal, but there's still a plaque up about that, the parentectomy. Mind-body is huge. Journaling, they did a study in JAMA where they had journaling. People with asthma journaled 3 days, 20 minutes a day, that was it. I mean, can you imagine the grant? Just a pad of paper and a pencil. And then at 2, 4, and 16 weeks later, that was all the journaling they did, those three sessions. 2, 4, and 16 weeks later, they measured FEV1s, or basically airflow from these individuals. And the improvement was remarkable. And it persisted. Even from those 3 days, they were journaling the most impactful and most emotionally upheaval events in their life. The control group was doing diary entries. They didn't see any change whatsoever in the FEV1. And I actually called the authors because I said, wouldn't that emotional upheaval of writing about stressful events make your asthma worse? And they said, yeah, we thought so too. It wasn't the case. Huh. So mind-body is huge and it's not used much.
My experience is that one of the most distressing symptoms that people can experience is air hunger. You know, that can occur in other respiratory diseases as well, the feeling of not being able to get enough air in. And I think if anything you can teach people to do to help them relax and not be as distressed by that, I use the 4-7-8 breath, but I think there's other techniques that can be helpful also.
You know, and breathing exercises were shown to help asthma in general. They didn't assign it to a mind-body practice, instead saying maybe it's a pulmonary effect, but articles have been published showing that breathing exercises are really valuable in folks with asthma.
I'd like to hear from you what you think the effect of air pollution and, you know, potentially other environmental toxins
Wow. Yeah. You know, there's a famous case in Great Britain, and I don't have it at the top of my head, of a young girl who died, and the cause of death was listed as air pollution. Someone had asthma.
She had 9 million other people a year.
Yeah. What was remarkable here was it was the first time pollution was listed as a cause of death.
Mm-hmm. You know, one type of pollution that has become much more common is forest fires. Mm-hmm. Smoke, breathing smoke, I think, is one of the most harmful things to the respiratory system. And an awful lot of people in the West are being exposed to the smoke.
And it's now not just the trees that are burning, but the products of combustion from people's homes that bear a lot of additional chemicals beyond the wood.
Right, right. And there are so many compounds in wildfire smoke that trigger asthma. I mean, it's a huge list. And my patients who often vacation there, and both in Canada and in the Northwest, have to leave, especially in California. Everything blows. And it's ridiculous that we have so many air alerts, even in areas without wildfires. I mean, in Arizona now, we're getting days that are low on air quality. And yeah, it's just scary. But that has to contribute to asthma exacerbations. There's no doubt in my mind.
So how well does a HEPA filter in the bedroom or the home or the office work in that situation?
It works well. The problem is if you're in a tough area with a lot of wildfire smoke, mm-hmm. you'll have to change filter frequently. The only thing HEPA filters don't work well for, a lot of allergens, when people put them in their home for some allergens, cat allergen, for example, is very sticky and floats, and mm-hmm. often it will stick to the wall, stick to the floor. So some allergens are really difficult to get out of the air with HEPA. But if you're talking about environmental, if you're talking about pollens, things like that, absolutely. HEPA filter is worth an investment, especially if you can't afford one for the whole house, put it in your bedroom and seal it off somewhat.
So where are we now with the hygiene hypothesis? It was so interesting as, that became more widely known that maybe we're just too clean. Maybe we're not getting exposed to parasites enough. You know, it's wonderful we're preventing all these viral illnesses with vaccines, but maybe there's a consequence in how our immune system develops. What's the thinking currently?
I think the current thinking is, again, rather mixed. We come into situations, the hygiene hypothesis, the pendulum swings, we expose our kids to everything. I don't know if they still have chickenpox parties and things like that. They expose kids to everything. And then there's a pandemic, everything swings the other way. So for years, kids are being isolated again. So I think it's up in the air. I don't think there's consensus at this point, but it's a rich area for study. I wish I could give advice and say, expose your kids to everything at one time, but we just don't know.
Randy, I feel like you've given us so much wonderful information. Are there other things you want people who either themselves have asthma or have children or grandchildren with asthma? What else should people know?
Well, since we are all involved in integrative medicine, I have to say that there are other modalities, and we're gradually changing conventional thinking. For example, there's a famous doc named Zumin Lee, who was at Mount Sinai, now is somewhere else. And she came to Mount Sinai, and Hugh Sampson was in charge of allergy there. And he was the president of the Allergy Academy, and he's pretty rigid. And she said, I have formulas that I use in acupuncture when I was young that work for asthma. And he said, okay, you can take a little time and look at it. She found from ancient texts formulations, and she wanted to try them first on animal models. And he said, okay, but you've got to take every one of those and purify it. I want to see the mass spectroscopy on every one of those 13 different components. She went through the arduous work of doing that, went through it, took several years, came up with a compound that she named ASHMI, A-S-H-M-I. It had three things in it. It had licorice root, it had reishi, and it had safra. Those were the three she pinned down from the 13. She used it on animal models, and it worked as well as corticosteroids, but it did not immune suppress against what they call Th1 or normal infections. So it was a non-immunosuppressive targeted therapy. She tried it in people, and again, it worked in a large proportion of people as well. I don't know the status of it right now. I know that they submitted to perhaps patent it and everything. But I think the key with asthma is keep looking for things that might work for you. And obviously don't do anything without the advice of a trained clinician, and hopefully someone trained in integrative medicine. They can guide you through these. You're not going to start new therapies and drop your old therapies without adequate supervision, because asthma is still a serious condition, still kills people. So you have to treat it with respect. But having said that, you have to have an open mind as well to other modalities.
Well, Randy, this has been such a rich conversation, and I just really want our listeners to appreciate your expertise. And you are, of course, a core faculty member at the Andrew Weil Center for Integrative Medicine, and have been so for two decades. And people who come and study with us get to study with Randy, not just Andy, Randy.
Thank you. Thank you. And yes, I did have the beard before I came here.
So. Got to grow it longer.
I know. It's turning white.